call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum, but we're going to get started anyway. So we'll start with the presentation, and once we get a quorum, I may interrupt you so we can officially call the meeting to order, okay? So if you'd simply state your name for the record and begin, please.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Dr. Rob Vinette, and I'm here representing the University of Minnesota's new invasive terrestrial plants pest center.
Good morning. I'm Heather Koop. I'm the Associate Director for the MIT PPC.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate this opportunity to follow up on the discussions that were had last week by this committee, talking about some of the exciting things that are happening at the university with respect to late-breaking issues that are affecting agriculture. And what we would like to do in a relatively brief presentation is just quickly to talk about why terrestrial invasive species are such a significant issue to the state, talk about the state's response to that issue through the creation of this new research center, and then what we've done to identify some important priorities, and then begin actual research projects that will affect the natural resources and agriculture within the state. So when we talk about terrestrial invasive species, we chatted with many different audiences about this issue, and initially when we throw that term out, eyes glaze over. And it's not until we actually say, well, we're really talking about things like emerald ash borer, gypsy moth, or soybean rust, or soybean aphids, that people start to get it. I mean, we don't have an iconic carp jumping out of a river or stream. And in fact, that's the challenge that many invasive species pose. These are often insidious problems, new insects, new diseases, new weeds that are showing up and are actually wreaking quite a bit of havoc on the state. With the species that we already have, this is a $3 billion a year problem. And the challenge that we have as a state is we know that there are new things coming, and we need to be prepared to deal with that issue. So as part of the response and remarkable foresight, you, thank you for this, as a body, asked the university to create the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center, and we thank you for the name as well as the funds to get us off the ground. And I will turn the mic over to Heather to talk about the initial creation of our center.
All right. Excuse me. We do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. I'd like to talk just briefly a little bit about the history of the MIT PPC. It is 2 years, almost 3 years old now. It's established by an act of the legislature in 2014, and its purpose is fairly straightforward. It's to create research and develop effective measures to prevent and minimize the impacts and threats posed by terrestrial invasive species around the state. And as Rob mentioned, it's really important for us to recognize that terrestrial invasive species are often crossover species. So the enabling legislation allows us to look at both the agricultural sector and the natural resource sector. So we're covering all land when we talk about terrestrial invasive species. And one of the things that we're finding is that many of them operate in both systems. And so I'd like you to keep that in mind. One of the key points I'd like to bring up regarding the establishment of the center is that it is based at the University of Minnesota. So it essentially operates as a grant remaking program. That we develop lines of research with faculty at the University of Minnesota. Research is really the critical element in developing means to have effective management. And to that extent, we work very, very closely with our land manager partners, whether they be in the agricultural, natural resource sectors. That research needs to be outcome-based, and it's what we call applied research. So we're not doing theoretical research here, although that is obviously something that's critically important in the scientific community. But we make sure that all of the grants and all of the programs that are funded have a strict applied purpose and partnerships involved to develop those lines of research. As I mentioned before, we include all lands. We do have a crossover with our sister center, the Aquatic Species Center, where we both deal with wetlands. So we work very closely with that center as well for projects that come forward to both centers. And finally, as I mentioned before, just to reiterate, we do deal with all terrestrial invasive species, whether they be plants, pathogens, or insects. We've had been very lucky to have the appropriations made to the center by the legislature. In addition to the general fund appropriation in 2014, we've had several subsequent appropriations from the Environment and Natural Resource Trust Fund. In 2014, we had about $1.46 million, followed by $5 million in 15, and then most recently in FY16, we have, FY16, $3.75 million. Of those funds, 2014, we funded four projects which are undergoing in development right now. Some of them are very close to their end time, and so their deliverables will be very soon. We've just finished a $5 million grant round, and we're ready to announce those grants later this week or early next week. And out of that $5 million, we'll be funding 11 research projects. We will be letting a new call for proposals next week for the $3.75 million. So we hope by the end of this calendar year to have over 25 projects up and running. One of the things that we like to show people and talk about in terms of an analogy is it's really difficult for people to understand the scope of the impact of terrestrial invasive species. So if you think about the dollars that have been allocated to the center since 2014, you think of that as a one-and-a-half-story building. Compared to the impact of terrestrial invasive species, which is three times taller than the tallest building in the world. So that gives you some idea of the scale and scope of the arena in which we're working. It can be overwhelming, but we feel that through our prioritization process and the tools that we have at our disposal, that we're making great headway there. The value of the center really is in a variety of means. I mentioned the prioritization process, and that is the key element of the enabling legislation and also guides the work in the RFPs that we have sent out to the public. Prioritization process was a very deeply embedded stakeholder-involved process, working with departments of natural resources, departments of agriculture, a number of other land managers throughout the state to develop a series of lists, if you will, of prioritized lists of species. And we published a paper last spring called the 124 pests, pathogens, and insects that were were looked at in depth by the scientific community, a great deal of scientific literature review done on them, and we developed a series of lists that Rob will be talking about in just a few minutes. So that really organizes our funding. As you can imagine, with the number of species coming into the state, it becomes very difficult to focus, and the prioritization has been absolutely critical in that. I'd also touched on earlier the coordination. We feel this is really a very significant element of the terrestrial invasive species program, that we work lockstep with our land managers, because we know that if we develop the research and it's not used by the agencies and organizations that deal with invasive species, then our task has not been completed. So we think about that up front and not as an afterthought. We are very lucky at the University of Minnesota to have a great deal of talent. One of the first things I did when I came to the university 2 years ago was to do a scan of the faculty interests, and what I discovered very quickly is that there were over 80 faculty who have some expertise in terrestrial invasive species. That's a really great capital to be working with. And so what we're trying to do is to energize that capital to get it to work together, to look across disciplines, to look across colleges, and develop lines of research that will be most effective. Because this is a statewide initiative, we also work very closely with all of the other elements of the university. Even though we're based at the St. Paul campus, we work very closely with the ROCs throughout the state, many of them in your areas. We work with Extension, University of Minnesota Extension Service as well, and again through other means to integrate this different stakeholders. Right now we have a very interesting project that we're beginning with the soybean growers. I'm very interested in some of the research that we're doing specifically around soybean aphid, and Rob will talk a little bit about that in a minute. So we're also looking at industry and commodity groups as partners in this work too. One of the things that we were asked to do in the development of the Terrestrial Invasive Species Center was to develop and help build a new cadre of intellectual capital, again, to work on this area. With the, I cannot stress this enough, that the dedicated funding that we have for the center and the timelines that we are allowing people to work on these projects up to 4 years has been a major attractant for us to really get the very best graduate students and postdoctoral associates to come to work for the university. And that they are a stellar cast of characters, I might say, doing really terrific work. We're very, very lucky to have them at the University of Minnesota.
Ms. Coop, we do have a question. If it's okay to testify,
yes, please.
Can we take questions as we go?
Yes.
Is that okay? Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. On your slide here, under preparations, you have grad students and postdocs. Do you track those grad students and postdocs as to where they go after the university? Do they stay in the state? Do they go to work for the corporations that are located here, or for the seed companies or whatever? What's your track record of keeping those graduates that you speak highly of and we're glad to have in the state, helping the state for the next 25 or 30 years?
We'd like to take that. Doctor?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, our center is still fairly new. The projects that we funded have actually only been in operation for 1 year, so we've been able to draw in new talent into the state to begin to work on these issues in the form of the students and postdocs. What we're finding, though, is that people have a passion to stay here, and so I really can only speak to the supporting programs and the behaviors of previous graduate students and postdocs. And what we're finding is that they're looking for every opportunity to stay in the state. So, for example, we have a graduate student who graduated from the forestry department, found it very challenging to find a government position or even a position in industry, but is now working with Friends of the Mississippi as a consultant to that group. His passion was to stay in the state and continue to work on these important invasive species issues. So what we're finding is there is a good return on investment in terms of intellectual capital for the state.
Representative Mahoney.
And just as a follow-up, that would be something that your organization probably needs. I hope we, as a future legislature, start holding feet to the fire about keeping these smart and brilliant people in our state and tracking it and be able to prove it, not just come to me or come to this committee and say a nice sentence at the witness table, but actually show us where they're working, who they're working for, what kind of money they're earning, and what we're getting back for our investment. And don't ever use the ROI. I've heard that so many times. Explain to me exactly what it means. Don't just say we get an ROI of $1 for every 50 cents.
Dr. Renna.
Mr. Chair. Let's see where I am. The last thing I want to say about the preparation for graduate students and postdocs is that tied to that is our desire not to do a single or what we call one-off project. So we're really looking for a fully integrated research program that has the ability to be carried forth not only for a particular species but also for other species as well. And finally, communication. As I indicated earlier, that's a really important element of this program because we feel, again, very strongly that the research is only as good as its application. So, again, while we don't have a mandate to provide education or outreach under the funds, we do believe that our role is to assist those who do, such as the University of Minnesota Extension Office, the research and outreach centers around the state, as well as the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, all have really wonderful invasive species websites to provide management information and information about different species, and we work very well with those teams and to provide them the information that they need to get out to the people who are actually tackling these issues on the ground.
So to begin the work of the center, and hopefully we've already impressed upon you the challenge that's ahead of us, it's literally a mountain of issues that many different sectors of the state are confronting. And so at the request of the legislature, we began in earnest on a prioritization process, and we began to get the center up and running with what we call a rapid prioritization. And Heather referred to some of the major stakeholder groups that we brought in to talk about what are their needs from a research perspective to help them do their job more effectively or with greater confidence. And these were the three common areas that were identified. So it was clear that we need new tools to find these invasive species in the field and track their distribution. If you don't know where a new plant is, you can't manage it. It's that simple. And so we need new technologies to bring to bear on that, things like remote sensing, making that an affordable, effective technology is something that we're very interested in. There are also tremendous interest in new management alternatives. This can either be in the form of biological control agents or refinements to integrated pest management. Quite frankly, when we talked about this, we talked about this as the, some have talked about it as the goat category. There's a tremendous interest in the state in using goats as a means to control invasive plants. NRCS is now allowing, Natural Resource Conservation Service is allowing goats as a form of plant control, and that's fine. The challenge is there's no research to back it up. We don't know if these goats are effective, how many years you have to have them on a site. We don't know what they do to native plants. We don't know if they're bringing in new seeds, new weeds, as they're being brought to a site. So we appreciate the passion, but the passion is a little bit ahead of the research. And so to prove that it's an effective approach, we need more people looking at that as a challenge. And lastly, there's a real desire to think about future conditions. There's a lot that's changing within the state, and those changes in many respects are going to affect what new invasive issues we have, and we need to be prepared to deal with that.
Doctor, we have another question. Chair Anders.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned that the NRCS has approved the grazing of goats for noxious weed control. Does that mean that they could graze those on CRP or federal program lands?
Dr. Vanette.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's outside my area of expertise. I really don't want to speak to that particular bit of legislation that they have under. So we can get that information for you. We have contacts within the NRCS if that would be helpful.
Right. Chair Anderson.
Thanks. Just to explain, you know, grazing is not permitted on CRP land, but as you mentioned, it would make sense if you're trying to eradicate the buckthorn, for example, that the goats, I guess, love that, and they eat that as their choice. So it makes sense to do it, but right now it's against federal regulations, I guess.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, they also love apples. Yeah, so if you happen to have an apple tree, keep it away from the goat. So after doing our rapid prioritization, what we also found that we were able to identify some really exciting projects. And many of these do have some relevance to agriculture or agricultural issues. The first one is not so much, it's more of a natural resource issue, but it's a significant one in the state. For those of you who are landowners and might have oaks on your trees, you may be, or on your lands, you may be familiar with oak wilt. It's the most significant pathogen issue affecting hardwoods in our region. The challenge with it is that it's very hard to identify. In fact, it's frequently misdiagnosed. And so we've attracted someone, a technologist, an engineer, who's never worked on invasive species to begin to develop new tools to identify it reliably in the field. He's already developed three patents for the work that he's done within his first year on the project. We're very excited about that. Buckthorn does not have a direct impact on agriculture, but it does indirectly impact it. That's because, as many of you may know, it's the overwintering host for soybean aphid. It's also a host for oat rust. And so oftentimes we think about buckthorn as a natural resource issue again, but its implications for agriculture are actually quite significant. And so we're developing a new method to deal with buckthorn more effectively, and quite frankly, to get off the treadmill that many natural resource managers are on. Basically, of going into a buckthorn stand, cutting out those stems, treating the stumps, and then just waiting for the new crop of buckthorn to come back. And our scientists have a new strategy to deal with that issue. We could talk about that more if there's interest. There are two other projects that do have more direct impact on agriculture. One is the new brown marmorated stink bug that is just showing up within the state. We have populations that are now showing up well-established in the Twin Cities. Wyoming, Minnesota is an area where we're seeing recurrent populations. This last summer, we also found it in soybean in the Rosemont area, not only adults but nymphs. And this insect does have a reputation for being a pest of both corn and soybeans. but its greatest impact back east, particularly in the Pennsylvania and North Atlantic states, is to apple production. It's caused over $37 million in damage to apple producers in a single year in that region. And this is an insect that we do not want to become widespread, and so we're developing new tools to find it more quickly and earlier in the infestation process. Lastly, we launched a new project. This is in the College of Biological Sciences with Dr. David Mahler, trying to forecast the distribution of new weeds that either are not here or have just a tiny foothold. He's working on 9 different species, and I guess we feel fortunate in a way, because although that's not a picture of pulmonary amaranth, we know that's certainly of concern to this committee. We started this project before pulmonary amaranth showed up in the state. And I think that speaks to the value of this center, is that we're trying to be prepared when these issues begin to show up. So we know that there are more than just 4 priority pest issues out there. In fact, there are literally hundreds more. And so what we did in the beginning of 2016 was to take a more comprehensive look at the broad landscape of issues. So in addition to the 3 priority areas that I've already mentioned, we added a 4th, and that deals with this issue of economics. What is the impact that these invasive species have on different segments of the economy, as well as what is needed for an appropriate management response? So we worked with our state partners to identify a list of over 124 species. I won't go into the great details of everything that was done to analyze those species, other than to say that it was a very comprehensive process, and it involved a team of nearly 30 individuals when all was said and done to get us to this point. What I did want to draw your attention to were the number of factors that we did consider when ranking these species. There are over 17 different categories that we've asked about. What I want to draw your attention to, I won't go into these individually, but you'll notice that on the left-hand side of that graph, those are all factors that relate to the impact that these species might have, either to the economy or to the environment. And you'll see that what this graph shows is the relative importance of those issues to these stakeholders, and it's really impact-driven. I think that's the bottom line. How people are perceiving these invasive species are really driven by their potential impact at the state, lesser so by how likely it is that they would get here and become widely established. So I just want to share some highlights of that. We're not going to go through all 124 species. In fact, we won't even go through the top 15 on each of these, but I did just want to draw your attention to where our initial priorities lie. Mountain pine beetle is an example of an insect that could be devastating to the forest industry if it were to arrive. For those of you who have traveled back west, you've probably seen mountainsides turned red because of the effect of this one insect. This single insect is transforming the western forested landscape. We don't have it in the state yet. We need to work diligently to keep it out. And so that was identified as our overall number one threat. Perhaps not a surprise to you, you'll notice that soybean aphid is probably one of the most significant agricultural issues, and it's turned out as our number 3 pest of concern. On the disease side, to highlight a few examples, again, you'll see that there are several issues of concern to the forest industry, but also to agriculture. And so there are issues such as sudden soybean death is one that we're very concerned about, as well as an old issue of fusarium head blight. So we're, again, trying to identify many different issues that cross over into different environments. And then lastly, we identified these top 15 plants as a concern to the state, so spotted knapweed, tansy, honeysuckle, buckthorn, common reed, just to top out the list. So again, that idea that we're trying to protect all lands, you will see that all lands effectively are represented here. So based on that set of prioritization, we've been able to vet quite thoroughly a number of different projects. Heather alluded to the fact that we've now identified 11 that we would like to fund. They amount to about $4.5 million in total funding. Of those, there are several that do directly relate to agriculture. Trying to advance soybean aphid biocontrol soybean aphid is continuing to prove to be one of the most significant challenges for soybean producers within the state. There are concerns that those methods of control currently may also be having unintended environmental impacts, and we're trying to work together with the industry in a way to develop a more sustainable method of controlling that insect. We're also launching a project to develop remote sensing technologies to better find this insect in the field and to develop soybean aphid-resistant varieties as a more long-term sustainable solution to this very important problem. We're also working on soybean sudden death, again, looking at new methods, new varieties that would be more profitable to producers in the long run, as well as protecting the environment. Fungicides, if overused, certainly can be quite devastating and have unintended consequences. There's also a new insect that's showing up in the state, spotted wing Drosophila. This is a major concern to our berry producers in the state, so relatively small acreage but extremely high value. We learned that in the last production season, a number of raspberry growers in particular within the state were devastated by this insect and had to disc up their cane fields, effectively going out of that part of their production business. We need new solutions. This research project begins to address that. We also have another buckthorn-related project that we're excited about. What's interesting about this, as we've been talking about these projects with different members of the public, we've learned from the Minnesota Soybean Research Promotion Council that buckthorn is their new number one issue. In fact, they are discussing with many people at the university, is it feasible to think about a buckthorn eradication program within the state? And we're in the very initial stages of that discussion, but the soybean producers realize how significant buckthorn is to their one of their long-standing production issues. And so it's a great example, Heather alluded to this, of how it's not just an ag issue, it's not just a natural resource issue. If we can control buckthorn, we can have a direct benefit not only to natural resources, but also to agriculture. So one of the things, if you were looking at this list, I'm suspecting many members may have noted that Palmer amaranth does not show up in the top 15. I want to be clear, it was on the list. It actually was number 20 when we first evaluated it. But the process that we've used allows us to be very flexible and to update the list as new information becomes available. And the fact that Palmer amaranth was not in the state was a major factor in its lower ranking. So this last winter, when it was after it was first reported, we updated our list. And what's significant is that Palmer amaranth is now the new number 9 weed in our risk assessment process. So that allows us to then begin to think more strategically about work that could be done research-wise to address this issue. And so we've already engaged in conversations with Minnesota Department of Ag, specifically asking them what their research needs are and how we might help address that issue. Just quickly want to thank the numerous individuals that have helped make our center a success. The Environment Natural Resource Trust Fund has been our strongest supporter to date, but as well the U.S. Forest Service. In fact, I am an employee of the U.S. Forest Service, and they continue to pay my salary to serve as director of the center because they see the significance of this issue to so many different sectors within the state. And with that, I'll conclude my comments, but certainly if there are follow-up questions, we'd be more than happy to engage with you and address them.
Well, thank you for your testimony. We do have some questions. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I was interested in your comments on the using goats to control weeds in the Cottage Grove Regional Park, which is Washington County Park. They did dispatch goats last fall for that purpose. They did go home for the winter, but I expect that they'll bring them back. And I had some of the same questions on its effectiveness, so I'll be checking back, and that might be something that you're probably already aware of it, but I just wanted to mention that. And then also for the control of buckthorn, you still need to eradicate, you still need to cut it down, but the goats then will take care of the new growth, I guess, is the purpose. Is that accurate?
Doctor? Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. We do know that the use of goats is growing within the state, so we're not surprised to hear that. There are many different places that are also using them. The goats are intended to not only take out existing vegetation, and what we're learning is that they can kill quite large buckthorn trees within the stand. They are also helpful to take care of new seedlings. The challenge is that we don't know how many years in a row would be needed and if you're trying to completely eliminate buckthorn from the stand. So the new research that we've proposed is a complementary to many of these methods, but it's the idea that if you can establish resident plants, native plants, if you can seed them or put in seedlings, that the shade that they create is what's really needed to keep those little seedlings from growing. And it's the sunlight that makes buckthorn so successful.
Representative Jergens?
That's a follow-up.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question on page 7 of your handout, the top 15 diseases. The top slide at the bottom of the list is Fusarium head blight, and I believe that's commonly known as wheat scab. And that can devastate a wheat crop, really reduce the yield. So I'm curious as to how you rated these things, if it's an economic damage possibility that one is that low. Could you explain that?
Doctor.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the challenge that we have is that we're trying to identify the worst of the worst. And by that, we're asking not only what is its economic impact, but what is its impact to the environment. So what's interesting about Fusarium head blight is that it is a significant, it's a devastating pathogen to wheat and small grain producers. In fact, brewers, it causes a phenomenon known as gush. So if it gets into barley, which is a susceptible host, and that barley is used for beer, the beer will gush when it's opened, and consumers don't like that so much. So, but the issue is that pathogen has almost no impact to plants or native environment, and so that's why it is a bit lower.
Chair Anderson. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director, for coming. I notice on page 6, Emerald Ash Borer is still at number 2, and I would be remiss to talk about the effect it's going to have on our ag industry in northern Minnesota. And forestry is our agriculture, but it also, if our ash forests are gone, it's going to have a serious impact on water issues in northern Minnesota. So I'd like that you're still focusing on it, and I think we're going to have some real ongoing concerns.
Dr. Bennett?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, among the 11 projects that we're about ready to launch, we're very pleased to be able to say that we do have one that's specifically focused on emerald ash borer, and it's a new approach to dealing with that issue, trying to think about can we manage this more effectively, not just on a tree-by-tree basis, which is the approach that many communities have had to rely on up to this point, either cutting trees or treating individual trees, but now to think about this at a landscape scale and say, can we manage trees in such a way that by protecting a number, it confers protection to other trees in the landscape as well. And so it's an issue that we're actively working on because we share your concerns.
Representative Eklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there's a project going on in the Duluth area that we've talked about, but I just remind you that we've got one landowner in northern Minnesota who owns 14,000 acres of ash. So,
thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, you spoke of collaborations with a number of groups in many different ways. I'm just wondering, do you collaborate with the federal EPA, and if so, what's the implications to your funding of the 30% cut that's been requested?
Dr. Bennett.
Mr. Chair, Representative, at this point we have not collaborated extensively with the Environmental Protection Agency. There are concerns about the fate of that organization and several other federal agencies. That's why we rely on the number of different partners that we do, because we're trying to build a sustainable program long-term.
Representative Mahoney, follow-up? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on Representative Eklund's issue with Emerald Ash Borer, I did talk with Representative Fabian, and we will be doing a motion on the floor today to move the bill that was sent to his committee. So as we discussed yesterday, it will be coming to your committee on the funding for Emerald Ash Borer.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Dr. Minetti, you were talking about the need for a database here on one of the slides to be able to, let's see, it was on page four, priority topics. When you're talking about that, you talked about a need for a database. My question is, we actually, we being the legislature, funded some dollars to the DDL, Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, so that they can do some tracking, have a network, a database, so they can do some tracking of antibiotic resistance and disease and whatnot. What specifically are you, do you know currently, my question is, I guess, what specifically is your needs there? How far along are you as far as getting this implemented? What do you need from us?
Mr. Chair, so to be very clear, the, when we talk about detection and distribution, it's more than just databases. In fact, in a sense, the database becomes the end repository for finding these things in the field. So our research center is more focused on the front end, getting people the tools to be able to go out and find them to report back to these databases. So when we talk about the brown marmorated stink bug example, the team of entomologists are developing a cell phone app. That app is meant to be shared with very broadly, growers in particular, trying to work through the soybean community to increase awareness. But the idea is that that's a reporting tool, and that goes to a repository that's known as EdMaps. It's a national tool. And what's nice about that as a national program is that we're not paying the maintenance costs for that database. And that's one of the long-term concerns in any sort of database development, is who's going to fund its maintenance long-term and keep it usable for the public at large. And so this has a long-term history. Its use is only growing. And at this point, maintenance costs are not an issue that we have to confront. So we're tapping into existing resources where that makes sense. We're developing the tools to feed into those national databases.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I want to thank you for your testimony today, and we do have your contact information if we do need any additional information in the future. So, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move to the minutes. Who'd like to approve the minutes?
I would like to move the minutes, so Mr. Chair. So moved.
Representative Poston moves the minutes for February 23rd. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We also, we only have one set of minutes. Is Representative Swazinski here? Representative Swazinski, we'll go ahead and move yours first. I'll move House File 571 to be held over to for possible inclusion. Representative Swazinski, to your bill.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring House File 571 before you today. This is the same bill we moved in past sessions. We feel that this is exceptionally important. We heard from the prior testimony from the department and the overview just from our eradication standpoint from weeds and other invasive plants that we are definitely facing some opposition out there from Mother Nature. My district especially over in Lyon County and Yellow Medicine County have been kind of some of the first counties that have seen some of the Pomerant infestation. We feel that these dollars can help with that process. We have some folks here to chat a little bit about that direction, and just appreciate the opportunity to come before you. So, thank you.
Thank you. To testifiers, state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Mr. Chairman, Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and I would like to kind of testify, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, a little latitude in support of House File 1442, House File 571, and House File 441. You can kind of cut and paste my testimony to each one of those, because certainly the Soybean Growers Association, and from visiting with some of you, you can understand how concerned we are with invasive species, whether it be buckthorn or, as Representative Swazinski just said, talking about Palmer amaranth. And although Palmer amaranth is one of those things that's relatively new to Minnesota, it certainly isn't new to southern United States and so forth, and Iowa in particular. And so it's not that far away. And we are very concerned about the emergence of Palmer amaranth in the state of Minnesota. As Representative Szczesinski had mentioned, we do have Palmer amaranth here in Minnesota now in Yellow Medicine and Lyon counties. And so we are asking that, you know, the legislature do what they possibly can to address this issue. Palmer amaranth, in particular, of all the noxious weeds, as I said, is something we're concerned about. In the state of Minnesota, we produced about $360 to $380 million of soybeans per bushel, bushels of soybeans per year. That's about $3.2 billion worth of commodity. If Palmer amaranth got to the point where it has in southern parts of the United States, it could cost the farmers in Minnesota billions of dollars. It could affect soybeans up to 80% of the yield. And so that is of particular importance. Palmer amaranth is also one of those things that it produces a tremendous amount of seeds, and they're very tiny seeds. But we're talking anywhere between 250,000 to 500,000 seeds per plant. And as I mentioned, they are very tiny. And you can imagine if those plants are allowed to progress, how devastating that could possibly be. So another concern, obviously, with regards to not just weeds in general, but Palmer amaranth, is that it's tremendously adaptive. It has developed resistance to herbicides and is proving to be a very tough customer, proving to be very hard to eradicate. In fact, although some herbicides can be effective, the best way to get rid of it is to till it up and burn it. And obviously, that you can imagine what that would mean to our agricultural producers. So I would ask, I know that budgets are tight. I know that dollars are going to be hard to come by, but if there's a way that we can get some dollars into these programs to try to help with invasive species in general, but also address the Palmer amaranth issue, would be greatly appreciated by the Soybean Growers Association. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bennett. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bennett, I agree with you on the need for this and the consequence of dealing with it. The one place where I disagree with you is that you said budgets are tight, and we just had the forecast that we have $1.6 billion. And I think that the appropriations here are prudent investments. If, Mr. Chair, if your target is larger, which I hope it is, that it would seem these would be prudent investments to help our overall ag industry. So I disagree with you just a little bit there on budgets being tight, that we could, with those dollars, make those investments that would have a long-term a consequence.
So, Mr. Bennett, I think that comment was directed more towards me than it was towards you.
Quite possibly, that, right? Mr. Chairman. I know that targets haven't come out yet, but certainly if with the budget surplus of dollars could be prioritized for this, or there can be a different prioritization of dollars, it would be greatly appreciated. So anything that you can possibly do as the finance chair, we would look forward to. Thank you,
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
I think he's blushing, actually.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. It doesn't happen very often, Mr. Chairman.
All right. See no other questions for Mr. Bennett. We do have another testifier. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Chaplin. I'm a senior scientist with the Nature Conservancy, and I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 571. In 2009, the Minnesota legislature rewrote the noxious weed laws, and in those rewritten laws were two new creations. One was an advisory committee to help the Commissioner of Agriculture revise and update the noxious weed list, and the second thing was a noxious weed grant program to allow the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to provide funding to counties, municipalities, and other weed management entities in order to carry out noxious weed work. Now, the advisory committee currently consists of 19 members from different agencies and organizations, and including the Minnesota Association of Counties, the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners, the the Minnesota County Ag Inspectors, the Minnesota Township Governments, Minnesota League of Cities, Minnesota Nursery Industry, the Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Farmers Union, University of Minnesota, and four state agencies. I serve on that committee, and I'm testifying on their behalf. Now, in the 7 years since the noxious weed law was rewritten, the noxious weed program at MDA has become a model program nationally. One success story that we've all been talking about, the Palmer Amaranth, is that that risk assessment and listing of Palmer Amaranth was done in 2015. That was a full 2 years before it was found in the state. That's exactly the way the risk assessment program is supposed to work, to identify things that are going to be major threats and get that listed ahead of time so that when it gets here we can move very rapidly. This is in contrast to some of our neighboring states who didn't start the process until after it arrived in their state, and they were hamstrung by the fact that it wasn't on their list when it actually got to the state. Now, nearly all of the control and management of noxious weeds, as well as the enforcement of the noxious weed law, takes place at the local government unit, and primarily counties. And when the law was rewritten, the law's proponents envisioned funding that MDA would grant to local frontline workers in the battle against this noxious weed to help pay for some of that unfunded mandate so that their counties and municipalities and townships could get that work done. Now, unfortunately, this noxious weed grant program has never been funded, but this bill, House File 571, will do that by providing $500,000 next fiscal year and $500,000 the following fiscal year that would flow directly to local government units. At a time when species with tremendous potential impacts are not only at the front door but have found their way into the house, this money is sorely needed. So for these reasons and more, the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee urges your support of House File 571.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Very thorough. Thank you so much. Or is there anybody else that would like to testify for or against this bill? Please come on down. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is James Calkins. I am a production and landscape horticulturist. And to actually a comment made by Representative Mahoney earlier, I am a University of Minnesota trained PhD working in the state of Minnesota. I represent the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association today. We are also a member of the Noxious Weed Advisory Committee, and we certainly support the comments that were just made by Mr. Chapman. Our industry is an industry that is often overlooked as being a part of agriculture. We are a part of agriculture, even though we have small acreage. Like all horticultural crops, they are very high-value crops, and they are very important to the economy and the citizens and the environment in the state of Minnesota. Noxious weeds and invasive species are a very big issue for us, including Palmer amaranth. Weed management is a big part of our production and landscape management. And we are very supportive of funding that would help the Department of Agriculture manage these species in coming years, both Palmer amaranth and all of the other species. So we are very much in support of this type of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. You're absolutely right. In fact, myself and Mr. Knisley were talking just yesterday about how landscaping, nurseries and landscaping, is absolutely agriculture. Just yesterday we had that conversation. So thank you for coming down here and testifying today. Any questions for the testifier before I let you leave, I guess? Seeing none, thank you so much. Next testifier, please. State your name and who you represent for the record. Begin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Townships. This is my, I believe, 17th session lobbying for the townships, and for all 17, we've been seeking funding as provided for in House Files 571, 1442, and 441. I hope this is the year that we can actually get it all the way to the finish line. I believe the last 2 years we've had it in the bill, and it's had been dropped in final negotiations. This is a very important role that our town officers take seriously as weed inspectors. They cover all parts of the state. It's the one mandate our members have actually actively voted on to support, that they remain weed inspectors, because it's that important to the economy in rural Minnesota. And so we hope that the state will be able to finally step forward and give us the funding necessary to expand the program, do the education, and help eradicate these weeds. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony. Any last words?
I just appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee, and I would really just implore the committee to make some room for some dollars within your budget for this particular, as having a county that is at the forefront of this battle, I think they can make a difference. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. I'll renew my motion that House File 571 will be held over for possible inclusion. Next up, Chair Anderson, are you ready? Do you want to go? So, Representative Anderson, which bill would you like to take up first?
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Let's take up House File 199. So, Representative Anderson moves House File 199 to be held over for possible inclusion. The bill's before us. Please, do your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was going to say the best part about this bill was its outstanding ROI, but Representative Kennedy just left. But this bill, we've heard it in the policy committee and made some changes. It was a bit onerous, I found out, in terms of asking Extension, DNR, other folks to make these notifications. And so we've scaled it back. And what's left here is that when the eradicate list weed is discovered, the Ag Commissioner would post a notice on his website and then also try to get the word out in the appropriate agricultural media. And we had a discussion on that the other night in policy, if that was specific enough to accomplish what we would like. But we thought, you know, in rural areas, this would be a big deal if the weed is discovered, and thought about the Linder Farm Network, our local radio stations, things like that, that if the commissioner got the notification to folks like that, we're fairly certain that they would make room for public service announcements, things like that, and get the word out that the weed had been found on in a particular county. So, Mr. Chair, that's what this bill does. Requires notification by the Ag Commissioner when the weed is confirmed in a particular county.
All right. Any questions for Chair Anderson? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. So if a noxious weed is found in my district, then how would people be notified?
Representative Anderson. You're talking about on the eradicate list. Again, the commissioner would have it on his website. And, yeah, you've mentioned before that where you are, local radio and things don't have the reach that they do out in the rural areas. I don't know. It would be on the website, and if there is cable available or things like that. But, to be honest, I hadn't thought about that. And Representative Hansen, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think particularly with transportation, the people moving around, we shouldn't limit as to who the media could be, because, you know, I don't know if even the Pioneer Press would be classified as agricultural media if there was a notice in the paper. So I think we want to try to engage all Minnesotans in terms of doing this, and I agree that the website isn't enough because people may not go there, but I actually think trying to engage more social media and get that out with folks may be a way. But that's my concern, Mr. Chair, and I would be, I don't know, you're laying this over.
Correct.
So maybe we can work on that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we did have a fairly robust discussion about this, I think, the other night, but the other thing I wanted to point out on your lines 1.16 is that when it talks about the commissioner shall post notice on the commissioner's website and an appropriate whatever, the commissioner can't actually post in the media. He can notify the media. So maybe it does need to be cleaned up just a little bit, and maybe it could just be provide notification to county officials, maybe, because the county, whoever that might be, and then to provide notification also to the public, private, and social media. I don't know if, I mean, I think that you can expand it, and now is not the time to actually put together an amendment for this, but I think in recognition of what Representative Hansen has raised, and maybe there is just a little bit of yet not thorough clarification on how the notice would be done. So just my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Anderson, I don't know if you want to comment on that, or we will open it up for anybody else who would like to testify. Is that right?
I suspect the work's not done on this bill yet.
Let's get it closer.
All right. I was just told that Mr. Sullivan's taking notes, so he may have some ideas.
It's in good hands then.
All right. This is a public hearing. Is there anybody else who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Any final comments there, Chair Anderson?
No, thanks, Mr. Chair. We'll take the comments here. Good comments. Thanks, Representative Hansen. And, this is a statewide issue. We'll try to address that, the notification piece. And when we come up with something, and I'm sure we will, it'll be, if it's laid over and included, we'll make that correction, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson renews his motion to have House File 199 be held over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson, you also have House File 1442. Representative Anderson moves House File 1442 to be held over for possible inclusion to your bill.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. I see we're well stocked in bills to provide funding for noxious weed.
Today is the noxious weed day,
yeah,
if you hadn't noticed.
Yeah, and they're all good. And you know, I was looking at the wording, and my idea in doing this was that get this money back to the local counties for their county weed inspectors. So that's why the wording in my bill on line 110 says that. But according to the last testifier for the Swazinski bill, his bill would do the same thing. So my concern is, just getting some funding for this program. So although I think my bill is good, whichever one you choose, Mr. Chair, we just need to get that funding.
All right. Well, you have a vote on this committee. Swede doesn't. I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing.
And now that he's here, my lead testifier on this bill was Representative Erdahl. If he...
Fine piece of legislation.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Anybody else like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Representative Chair Anderson renews his motion to have House File 1442 be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Next on the agenda, Representative Johnson. Moving right through here. Representative Johnson moves House File 441 to be held over for possible inclusion. We have the bill before us. To your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just going to work from the assumption that you save the best to the last. And
always.
And I also just want to, in my opening comments, just want to note a couple of things that we heard in testimony today. Ms. Cook talked about the scale and scope of this can be overwhelming. And I believe she also, Mr. Bennett, referred to the complexity of fighting Palmer amaranth. And then also that Mr. Chaplin talked about the noxious weed program run by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture as being a model program nationally. And what's different about this bill, 441, is that it does specifically look towards the Department of Agriculture for taking the lead on addressing noxious weeds and Palmer amaranth, and I see it, envision it also as including the staffing request that and the funding request that the governor's made related to this, and so I'll turn this over to Ms. Place and she can talk about that.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Place, state your name for the record, who you represent, begin.
Thank you. My name is Whitney Place. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate Representative Johnson's bill to fund our noxious weed program. As you know, the governor's request is for $300,000 to increase our staff by 3 full-time noxious weed staff, a half-time staff assistant, and increase our IT capabilities to track and trace weeds. That being said, I would also like to voice our support for funding of the grant program. And we would advocate that this would be a package deal so that some of the administrative costs of operating the grant program could be covered by some of our staffing in our request.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers, member? Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Trying to be impartial here, but again, I think the focus of any funding that we provide is local funding. And Ms. Place just talked about adding 3 staff members at the department. And that may be all well and good, and if we can do that, fine. But I think our focus should be mainly on funding our county weed inspection programs.
Ms. Place, would you like to comment, or Representative Johnson?
Yeah, I will comment. I think, you know, the approach that I've taken is to do both. And first of all, I agree with you. We need money. Funding going to the local weed programs, and I've supported that in the past. I shall continue to support that, and maybe it's a matter of combining these bills and maybe even extending the money beyond what we're talking about to afford that. But I'll tell you, my experience over the last couple of years, especially with response to avian influenza, that there's a statewide response. There's a statewide responsibility on the challenges that are facing us. I look at the map, and as Mr. Bennett reminded us, Palmer Amaranth is down in Iowa. That's getting close to my neck of the woods, and the threat is very real. It's currently, we're facing, you know, speaking specifically to that, we're facing that in a couple of counties. Well, what if we see that in other counties? We need a statewide response to this, specifically Palmer Amaranth, but also what we learned today about buckthorn. An ongoing statewide response. And I think the Department of Agriculture, one thing I've learned in the last 4 years is that the Department of Agriculture is a tremendous asset to agriculture statewide. And I hope there's room in here to see it, to also adopt the statewide response. How that balance works, maybe it's not the full amount of money that would be coming in the proposal that you bring forward, Mr. Chair, but I hope that you do bring forward a very robust approach on noxious weeds, and that it does include the Department of Agriculture and some funding for the Department of Agriculture so that they can do the job that they need to do. They've proven their abilities in the past in other areas and similar areas, in my opinion, and I think we need the statewide response in fighting noxious weeds as well, and we need it now. We're seeing an escalation of the challenge. Now's the time to deal with it. Let's, as a committee, come through as we work through and really support this financially and significantly. And again, I remind of what Representative Hansen said. We do have a $1.65 billion surplus, and I think agriculture is depending on some of that surplus going into fighting noxious weeds, and I hope that we can do that.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions from the members? Can't remember if I asked. Anybody else like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, then Representative Johnson will renew his motion to have House File 441 be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Members, just a little bit of a roadmap here. If you have bills that have been referred to our committee and you have not submitted a hearing request and you'd like a hearing, please get that in. We're going to move pretty quickly. We're going to be hearing all the bills here next week, wrap them up early the week after, and then I'd like to have a delete all. We'll hear the governor's bill or have a delete all. What would that date be? Around the week of the 20th, is that right? Is when we'd like to do it. So we're going to move pretty quick here and to get the bill out of committee here by the a little over 2 weeks we'd like to get the bill out of here is what I'm thinking. So again, if you want a hearing on your bill, please get a hearing request in and we'll make sure we get you on the agenda. All right, With that, we have no other items of business. Thank you. We are adjourned.